coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello everybody, and happy Tuesday night. Sorry for the little tech glitch there at the beginning during the hold session, folks, but things have been wild and crazy here in the studio. We have been getting ready, number one, for episode 200. That is right around the corner, literally just a few weeks away. We're going to be having a great episode that will be pre-recorded. As many of y'all know, with our schedule online, we will be going to a few conferences coming up. That Tuesday in particular will be my travel day to go provide all the AV for the International Remote Viewing Conference. For the International Remote Viewing Association in Cloudcroft, New Mexico. So that's going to be wicked awesome. I cannot wait. We have the 9/11 Truth Conference coming up. Richard Gage was just on talking about that last week. I am very, very much looking forward to being in D.C. for that, talking with the researchers, talking with all kinds of people that will be there presenting. On that, I think, all important front. At the very least, we had a Pearl Harbor event that nobody wanted to say anything about. So we'll be getting into a bunch of that over the next couple weeks, folks. Our guest tonight in the second part, we will be joined by our good friend Ryan Edwards to talk about cryptid cats in North America and beyond. In this segment, we will be joined by Mike Ricksecker. The book is Travels Through Time. You can find it on not only Amazon, but also MikeRicksecker.com. That is Mike's website. He is all over History Channel, all over the place. He's literally all over conventions, all over the country. Welcome to the show. Once again, Mike Ricksecker, how are you?
Hey, thanks for having me back, Chris. I really appreciate it. And congratulations on almost 200 episodes now. That's fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm proud that we brought this show this far. I mean, we transformed from a previous show that went on for 350 episodes. I actively just posted an image today of my old studio from like 11 years ago. It was like, holy crap. It was just like a sealed up window with an AC unit in it.
Nice.
but just to know that, like, we've come that far, we've done that many episodes and never once like done repeat content, taken a week off. It's always been new stuff. So it's always exciting. It's great talking with guests like you these days. So, let's start getting into your book, Travels Through Time. The idea of the stacked time theory is fascinating to me, Mike. Where did you first come into this? How did you first come up with this concept of stacked time and the possibilities of time travel?
Yeah, well, you know, time travel has always been an interest of mine. You know, it's just, you know, dating back to when I was a kid watching films like Somewhere in Time. That was a favorite of mine. Of course, you know, we all grew up with Back to the Future and, sure, and films like that. So it was always, you know, interesting to me, you know, the different concepts that people have had in what time travel might really look like. And I always kind of leaned more towards travel, or more towards Somewhere in Time than Back to the Future, even though Back to the Future was super, super fun.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So in a lot of the research that I'd been doing over the years, going back like some 30, 35 years now, a lot of the paranormal supernatural research that I was doing, it just kind of, I don't know, one day to me kind of occurred, well, what if all this, what we call time, it was all current, all existed, and what we were seeing as far as like ghosts and hauntings and things like this were not necessarily ghosts at all, but we were actually seeing another point in time play out, and we were actually interacting with that other point in time. And so I started coming up with, you know, these different ideas of what I ended up calling stacked time theory. And as I was researching it out, you know, I was like, is there any merit to where my brain is going with this? And came across that Albert Einstein actually had his concepts of the block universe, and in the block universe, again, you know, all time is concurrent, past, present, future, all here right now.
Yeah.
The way that when you look at dimensions, you know, we are, our consciousness is in the fourth dimension. We have access to all the dimensions below us, first, second, third. And there are other dimensions up to 11 hyperspatial dimensions beyond ours. So that means, like, we have complete access to a 3D object, like, you know, this water bottle. Well, those outside of time, the fifth, sixth, seventh, and onward, would have access to time like we would have access to all the 3D objects around us. So that became a really, really fascinating concept to me. And so I likened it, since we are very visual people, that each moment in time is like a photograph in a giant stack of photographs. And sometimes, because everything comes down to frequency, energy, resonance, vibration, that two of those moments will resonate at the same frequency very briefly. And that's when you will have these moments slip into each other or meld into each other. And that's where, you know, we'll get some of these, what you might think is a ghost or a haunting or something like that, might actually be what we'd call a time slip. Yes,
yeah.
So there you go. Bizarre case of time slips. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And precisely the idea that, and of course, Einstein said that in, it wasn't special relativity, but it was the electro model, where light is traveling in all states of time. There is no past, present, or future to a particle or beam of light. It just is. Right. And it travels in all states of time simultaneously. So,
yeah. Just before he passed, he has this fantastic quote that time is just a stubbornly persistent illusion.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a phrase I say regularly on the show. It's the only made up part of science. It's the only made up part of physics is time, because it's an agreed upon concept that 60 seconds is a minute, 60 minutes is an hour. Like that's just the math of our planet. You move to Jupiter, you even to the moon, you need a totally different watch to tell time on the moon, because gravity is not the same.
Right, exactly. And they're looking at actually designating time zones on the moon to try to keep track of it. Now we have to branch out to the moon, and it's just a way that it helps us to describe a reality, help you show up to work at the right moment, help us to, you know, plant the crops and all that sort of thing. But you're right. It is something that we came up with on this planet. And as you go to other planets in the solar system, go to other planets in other solar systems, it's going to work very, very differently there.
Well, even the idea of the twin experiment from Einstein, the idea that, you know, a twin traveling at light speed is technically traveling through time at that point. If you sent them 50 light years out and sent them 50 light years back, everybody here would have aged by 100 years while they wouldn't have moved, you know? It's funky when you start getting into things. And once you start getting up to the speed of light, time as we know it, and even physics as we know it, really starts to break down into something totally different.
Yeah, yeah. Time, again, is, you know, when you start looking at these different concepts of what dimensions are, and, you know, I've had people ask me about, well, what about time dilation? I don't think stacked time or time dilation works with stacked time theory. And they have done experiments like the twin experiment with two astronauts that were twins, and they sent one up. And yeah, you know, because of gravity, time does work a little bit differently outside the planet, and they're a couple milliseconds off. Now, it's not, you know, that big of a deal, but when you get outside the scope of time, like, time dilation doesn't really even matter, because, again, time doesn't really exist. So this idea that, oh, it's going to work differently outside the planet than on the planet, it's irrelevant, because you're outside of time and it doesn't matter at that point.
Yeah. Well, and you brought something up earlier, especially the idea of frequency. That is something that we talk about on the show regularly, especially when it comes to not only the universe around us, but to the physics of the universe around us. And when it comes to time specifically, and the idea of time dilation, the idea of somebody being, quote, in the zone is a prime example of that, where a 90 mile per hour fastball slows down for somebody at home plate swinging. You know, it's interesting that we can even put ourselves into that moment of time dilation, and that we can experience it in that kind of way where we are in a suspended moment of time when we're in an adrenalized moment or something similar to that, where there is a shift of frequency in our body.
Yeah, and a lot of that comes down to, it comes down to perception.
Sure.
And it also comes down to the way that our three-dimensional body works. So, you know, it's we are fascinating creatures, and so are a lot of our animals, in that, you know, we are a fourth-dimensional consciousness inside a three-dimensional body. And so, yeah, we have a lot of these different frequencies that affect the physical body and our brains and our eyes and that sort of thing. So yeah, the way that gravity works, the way that, you know, a fastball might work, and I played ball, so
yeah.
So I understand exactly what you're talking about. But yeah, all that is still within the confines of the fourth and the third dimension. But once you start moving outside of that, that's where the rules change and become very, very different. And I think, you know, people have a hard time wrapping their heads around the idea of time not existing and all time being concurrent right now.
Yeah.
And what I throw a couple of analogies at them.
Please.
Like with, with the river of time, that's usually what we call it, just running straight, or people call it like the arrow of time. But with the river, the time is the water, and it's flowing downstream. Well, it's not the water that makes itself move. It's the banks holding it in place. You remove the banks, all the water spills out, and you're in like this big, giant, stagnant pond or lake where you kind of move about at will. Or the other one I like to use is of taking a town. And let's say you're driving through this town 35 miles an hour. There's some houses, a store, a post office, these sorts of things, a church, a gas station. And it takes you about 10 minutes to drive through the town. Well, you have a time relationship with that town. Now, let's say instead of driving through the town, you're flying overhead. And at that point, you're able to see the entire town all at once. You see all the houses, you see the store, you see the gas station, the post office, all that. And once what you once had a time relationship with, you now have a relationship with in space, and you're outside of time.
That is a very interesting way to put that, Mike, because it really does give you the two parts of time in that kind of way, and show you how it is fully relative to the observer, because it's the exact same amount of space that you're passing over. The only difference is the way you're looking at it. Either you're on ground level or you're on an overhead level. And
yeah, exactly. So when you come outside the fourth dimension of time, you're basically looking down on it like we would over in an airplane. But instead of just, a town, we're talking all time from the moment time began until time is going to end. You're able to see it all.
Well, and this is I'm a remote viewer. I was just at Psy Games, things like that. That is where a lot of remote viewing comes from, is the concept that there is no difference in time. There is no past, present, or future. Everything is a localized consciousness, basically. Yeah. And you and I are sharing in that localized consciousness. We can both pull data from different sides of it if we want to.
Absolutely.
And it is a really, really big concept to try and wrap your brain around. It's a big noodle to try to cook, so to speak.
It is, yeah. And on that note, one of the things that I also like to talk about with this is what I call eternal knowledge. Carl Jung called it the collective unconscious. You have others that call it the Akashic records. But, this idea that all the knowledge of the universe is at our disposal. Well, yeah, if time doesn't exist and all time is here right now, that means everything that has been learned and everything that will be learned is all here with us. And it's just a matter of being able to access that.
Well, because this is a prime time to switch gears in this conversation, Mike, to alchemy and the idea of not only previous alchemy, but modern day alchemy and the way that alchemy is a technology that through time has carried this concept with it. How do we connect to that alchemical past when we start discussing time in this kind of way, and specifically stack time and the non-existence of time, the ever-presence
Yeah, I mean, what I tried to teach people is that since it all does come back down to frequency, resonance, energy, vibration, that moving through time is more has more to do with the consciousness than it has to do with jumping into a DeLorean, zipping off at 88 yeah. miles per hour and all that, that, you know, it's going to take meditation, it's going to take a, you know, I believe everything comes down to intention. You set that intention to, you know, there's a certain time that I want to go to. There's something that I want to go see. And you get yourself into that meditative state and, you know, you'll basically project, to that particular location or like it's, probably very similar to what you do with remote viewing, but instead of, you know, someplace on Earth at this moment in time, it's somewhere on Earth at another moment in time.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And the idea that those things coexist and that once again, you can tap into it. This is something that has been spoken about in, once again, mystical literature, all kinds of things for millennia now. And I mean, the one of the prime expressions of it is, of course, the Ouroboros. The idea of the circular snake, the snake eating its own tail, yep. The fact that time itself doesn't exist, that we are in an ever-repeating cycle that we can influence.
Yeah, the Ouroboros is our oldest alchemical symbol, and it is used to signify that constant recycle and renewal. So our first depiction of that is actually on King Tut's burial shrine in ancient Egypt. And of course, they put it on his shrine because they want the, you know, renewal of his spirit. I mean, we have a very different outlook on the afterlife than they did back then. For them, it was just another part of the journey. You know, they were headed off to the constellation of Orion. They just didn't have this physical body anymore. They still existed as the soul, the consciousness. And so this was for that consciousness to return again here. And this was used all throughout the ancient world, this symbol of the snake eating its own tail, for whether it was for, you know, the consciousness for a person return. It was used for to signify the recycling and renewal of life on this planet as a whole. When we're talking about, you know, whether it's the trees or animal life or the Earth itself. And this extends even out to the universe and then, of course, time that, yeah, this all of our experiences here is this constant cycle. Even the planet that we're on now, this is not the first go around for this planet. You know, even physicists have shown that this solar system was born out of another solar system that existed billions of years ago. And here we are reformed. Well, the same thing is true of the universe itself. So what was before the universe? The universe was going to come after the universe, and it's going to form up differently. It was different before. Sure. This is the way it is now, and it's going to reform differently later. But it's this constant cycle again and again and again. So, and time is that way.
And at what point do you think that, I guess, between the alchemical means, between the mystical means that we believed in, at that point, at what point did we diverge and start looking at time the way that we do now instead of that ever cyclic, ever repeating concept? Because that once again is a concept that's mm-hmm. followed by numerous societies across the globe, numerous religious traditions. So at what point did we lose that and come to the point of a linear timeline, Mike?
Yeah, you had over the course as it were, apropos, as time went on back.
There's no way not to be punny.
There's no way not to use the word because it is our experience here. But back then, you had a lot of, you know, wars, genocide, nations conquering nations, these sorts of things, and so. Like ancient Egypt, for example, you know, went through a lot of different phases. We have, you know, the old kingdom, the middle kingdom, the new kingdom. And there's also the pre-dynastics and the pre-cataclysmics and all that, which, you know, when we had the great cataclysm, the world renewed and all of that. But over time, in ancient Egypt, you had the Persians invade and take over during one of those darker eras. Then the Alexander the Great came along with the Greeks. He's from Macedonia, but basically the Greeks took over after that. And then after the Greeks, it was the Romans. And so this knowledge got lost over time. And so these ideas and concepts were replaced. You know, the old gods went out and the new gods or God came in. And so, and then you had, you know, religious persecution and things like this that kind of stamping out a lot of that knowledge, and it got lost. And you know, we're still rediscovering a lot of it today when we find ancient texts, where we try to, you know, read the walls of the temples and are deciphering hieroglyphs and, you know, other languages that have been lost. You know, and I think when it comes to like Egypt specifically, because that's kind of centerpiece of what I work on.
Yeah.
They knew it was happening. And that's why during the Greek occupation, they covered the walls of the Temple of Horus at Edfu with all kinds of texts. It's amazing the amount of stories and history that are on those walls. And because I think they knew it was happening, that they'd already seen it start to happen with the Persians. Now the Greeks were in charge, and the Greeks like rechanged their changed the names.
Yeah, the Ptolemaic period was totally different.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, you know, they could see the assimilation, you know, when they were like the Rosetta Stone, we found that, which was great. It helped us to decipher the hieroglyphs. Well, that had had the hieroglyphs on there. It had Demotic on there, which was like a shorthand for the ancient Egyptian. And then it had the Greek on there. So it's just looking at a stone like that. And these were the steles that they would put outside the temples so that anybody walking by could decipher and read in their language what was going on here. They could kind of see, apropos, the writing on the wall, pun intended.
Yes.
So, and unfortunately, we did lose track of that when it comes to the hieroglyphic language. You know, around 300 AD is when the last guy who could read and write hieroglyphs back then passed away. And then it was another 1,500 years before we could read it again.
Wow. Yeah. And of course, in that time, everything came to the point of science almost as we know it, not quite as we know it, but, you know, pretty close to modern era with a lot of things, at least with a lot of, because, and it's something that we speak about regularly on the show, Mike, is some of the reticence of Egyptology to adopt a lot of newer findings, so to speak. There is a lot, even the idea of still pushing the idea that the Great Pyramid is a tomb. It's like, if that's a tomb, whoever you were going to put in that sarcophagus, you never wanted him to go anywhere.
Yeah, the whole idea that that huge structure was a tomb, and you would have to have guys working round the clock. You'd have to have basically it's like once every 3 minutes, a block quarried, shaped, brought up to the pyramid, and then placed once every 3 minutes for, if it's supposed to be this 25-year period in which it was built. So the math just doesn't work out on that. And I understand the pride that the Egyptians have. This is one of the oldest nations in the world. They have these amazing structures that are there. The Great Pyramid of Giza is the last surviving of the seven wonders of the ancient world. So there is there is pride there.
Absolutely.
But, you know, to redate it and say that, you know, there was an older portion of Egyptians, and whether they were, and I'll use the A word, if they were Atlantean Egyptians, because even you look at the Plato texts, you know, they do say that the Atlantean country spread through Africa, through Egypt, into Asia, of course, lots of parts of Europe.
Yep.
You know, so even if it was the Atlantean Egyptians, it was still, you know, part of their line. It's still part of their lineage. I think that they just want to kind of keep everything in dynastic Egypt, meaning old, middle, and new kingdom. And it just, as we continue to discover more things, some of those pieces just don't fit anymore. But
yeah,
to me, it's like, it's okay to say it's the older ones. It's all right.
Sure, sure. And hey, you know, we have Stephen Myers on the show probably a few times a year. I love his work with them possibly using water locks to build things, all kinds of stuff. Yeah. I do not believe that we I think that we are a bunch of honestly, like professors on the island, on Gilligan's Island. There will forever be a human being that you throw him on that island. He will build you some stuff, man. Like, right. There will forever be an Archimedes out there that give me a lever and I will move the world. You know, we don't need, I don't think, alien technology to build the pyramids, but there is definitely a different technology at use. And definitely a different method at use than what we would use today to build such a structure. And once again, it's definitely one that is not what they say it is.
It is. And you see that evidence all throughout Egypt of advanced machining that, you know, the traditional archaeology mm-hmm. says that they didn't have, like using circular saws to cut through
yeah.
granite, which you would need a diamond tip circular saw to cut through. And you see the cuts.
Yeah.
They're right there. And you can even see that they were circular, one on top of another, as they're, you know, cutting off like a sarcophagus lid from the underside of it.
Yeah.
And it broke off and they just abandoned the thing. You can see that's what happened. And no, to traditional archaeology is supposed to be stone and copper tools. And it's, but I'm seeing it right here.
Yeah, yeah.
They get hung up on that, you know, there had to be this straight linear progression of technology rather than there were ups and downs and peaks and valleys.
And much like us modernly, massive leaps sometimes. Yeah. Just massive
sometimes
leaps.
Sometimes you make a massive leap, yeah.
You know?
And just, you know, and some of the things that we were talking about earlier, when wars or famine or things like this happen, genocide, all that, that you lose technology.
Yeah.
A cataclysm happens and, you know, your entire country is decimated. You're trying to rebuild for years. You're just trying to survive. Yeah. And, you know, these skills that you had beforehand, you're not using them because you're trying to survive for that little time. So.
Well, and it doesn't take long. The two examples I give, number one, I am Cajun. You are hard pressed to find some. My mother just turned 75 mm-hmm. when I turned 50. Happy birthday, Mom.
Happy birthday.
But you are hard. She's 100% Cajun. She understands a little bit. She knows a few choice phrases. But you are hard pressed to find a Cajun my mother's age who speaks that language fluently, to the point that there is a revival of trying to teach kids Cajun in school again. And all it took was like a generation and a half, Mike. Yeah. It doesn't take long for an entire language that's been there since the 1500s, unchanged since the 1500s, and forgotten in a generation and a half.
In a generation, yeah. Well, the one that I like to throw out is you know, going to the moon. I know some people try to say, "Oh, we never went to the moon."
We
did go to the moon, but they're like, "Well, how come how did we forget to how we got there?" And you have to remember, we went to the moon 60 years ago. You know, those guys that worked on that project, most of them are gone.
Yeah,
you know, and we didn't keep going there. You know, we stopped. And then we decided, well, okay, we did this whole shot out there. We made it. The Russians gave up. We don't need to keep spending a bunch of money to go out there. So we stopped doing that. We just did all this stuff around our orbit. So those guys that developed that stuff are gone. Yeah, we have some blueprints and schematics around, but you're talking 1960s technology that you don't have those manufacturers. Some of those manufacturers are gone, or they're not making those parts anymore, or whatever they needed to do it. So you do literally have to reinvent the wheel again,
just about
to do it. Yeah,
exactly. And one of the examples I give regularly is if you were to go out right now and take like a 6x6 plank and try to find somebody to carve you a spiral column, there's probably 25 people that will give you a quote on a CNC'd column. Like, we will take that wood, we will put it into the computer, we'll CNC it for you, we'll have it to you in a week and a half. But finding somebody who is like a skilled woods craftsman.
I can connect you with my dad. He's got his lathe down there and he'll figure it out. Yeah.
And see, but that's just it. The idea of even that, like, that's within our lifetimes.
It is. And just in even just that example there, you know, he has this whole shop and he was a machinist for his day job. And then, you know, for his hobby, he, you know, build furniture. And I've got several pieces around my house that were built by him. And he's been looking for a while. Okay, I have all of these tools and everything. I'm getting up there in age. Who do I pass this on to? Because, you know, I know a few things, but
it's,
you know,
invaluable to somebody that does it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not my passion. He's been looking at the grandkids. None of the grandkids have really, you know, shown that much of an interest. And he's like, I've got all of this, all these skills and all this knowledge that I want to pass on to somebody, but there's nobody around that really wants to know. So I gave him a video camera. I said, start recording this stuff, throw it up there on YouTube, or just record it. And, you know, maybe a great grandchild down the road or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, we'll pick up an interest. But yeah, I mean, he's looking at that right now, that his skills and knowledge in woodcraft and machining is going to get lost.
Well, and you know, that brings us, I think, right back to the topic of alchemy and the concept of that, and even the hidden secrets that were occulted with alchemy, and the fact of that was passed on to very, very few, an elite few.
Yeah, it was. And then you had the persecution by, you know, the church for so many centuries that, you know, if you were caught teaching or using alchemy or anything, that now you're gonna get burned at the stake or hung or something. Yeah. So yeah, it was really very super secret and kind of squirreled away. And so a lot of that got lost.
Well, and of course, there's tons of hypothesis out there as to whether or not governments have tinkered with time travel, whether or not we went to Iraq to go get a Stargate, all kinds of things, which, you know, I don't really go for the whole Iraqi Stargate story myself.
Well, I don't know if it was a Stargate. I mean, because I've heard that, and do you understand what a real Stargate is?
Yeah.
We always think of the film. We always think of the film and the television show and all that, and that's not really what they were. So I can show you, you know, the Stargate chambers and all that in Egypt, and I don't think you're going to Iraq and dragging off these huge blocks with you to rebuild the chamber. Yeah. You also had to build it on top of specific spots that were energetic in nature. So there's a lot that went into it. Yeah. I do believe that. You know, because even the Iraqi officials are like, yeah, they came in here. They knew exactly where to go and specific pieces. So I do believe that there were some like kind of power pieces, smaller in nature, that they made off with and stole, but not entire chambers or something.
Well, and, you know, it's when you start getting into things, especially time paradoxes, stuff like that. Let's get into that for a minute.
Sure.
So, What kind of time paradoxes have you come across in your research, Mike?
Yeah, I have an entire chapter in the book on paradoxes. So, you know, it's kind of the classic ones, bootstrap paradoxes, grandfather paradoxes, which with the grandfather paradox, I always kind of laugh at that one because, okay, the whole idea, and we see this in, again, Back to the Future, where if you go back in time, and we call it grandfather paradox because the example is if you do something to kill your grandfather, so your mother or father is not born, therefore you are not born, and you don't even have to take it all the way back to your grandfather. And Back to the Future, he went back and he screwed up his parents' meeting, and that got a little creepy because his mother had the hots for him.
We'll
talk about that. So that's the whole idea. You know, how can he possibly exist if he damaged his parents' meeting? And so in Back to the Future, they made it like he was disappearing. I don't think that would truly happen if such a thing would occur. I think it just continues on. You've changed the timeline. I don't think you disappear because your physical being is still there. Scientists and physicists like to pawn that off as, well, that's science fiction. That's great for storytelling. But in the 1980s, there was a discussion that was going around because there was the Novikov consistency principle came about. And this was a Russian scientist who was discussing that, well, time travel, yes, while it could exist, you couldn't actually change anything because basically the math that would work out, it wouldn't, you would have a remainder. It wouldn't equal out to zero. And therefore, you know, it's not going to work because of math. So we had a couple other physicists, Kip Thorne and Joe Polchinski, that were discussing this. And Polchinski came up with this idea of, well, What if we shot a billiard ball through a wormhole? And wormhole, based on Einstein's theory of relativity and the Einstein-Rosen bridge, let's have that the end of that wormhole come out at such an angle that the billiard ball would pop out of the end just before it actually entered the wormhole and knock it off course. So therefore, how could the billiard ball go into the wormhole and knock itself off course if it never went in there to begin with? You know, hence your paradox. But yeah, when you look at all the players of this billiard ball in there and knocking it off course so it wouldn't go in there to begin with, it's the exact same thing as the grandfather paradox, except it's using billiard balls rather than people. So I just kind of laugh. Oh, okay. We're okay to discuss that because it's billiard balls and wormholes, and not grandfathers and time machines. So
yeah, yeah. Well, and the idea of yes, because at some point, that's what I was going to bring up with Back to the Future, is if he stayed there, at some point he would actively be running into himself, you know, like he does later on. Where they're both in number two, where they're both in the same locale, and he has to be careful not to hit himself, much like the billiard ball would eventually come out of the pocket or be there before the pocket and run into itself.
Yeah, so, and Back to the Future, if he decided to stay, again, I don't believe he would have actually disappeared if his parents didn't get together. But we'll go with the fact that, okay, the parents get together, he's going to be born. Let's say he didn't go back to 1985, just hung around and lived. Yeah, at some point, he is going to run into a younger version of himself. And we see that in, I don't know if you ever watched the television show Dark. It was a German television show that ran on Netflix.
No.
And they were running into multiple versions of themselves and did a great job because it was most of the story centered around three different generations, even though they did go into some others, but those three generations, my gosh, the casting was phenomenal because you're really looking at these three different versions of this person and you're like, yeah, they could really all be the same person, even though they're three different actors or actresses. And it's pretty amazing.
Well, and I think honestly the Avengers movie did a great job with kind of breaking the wall on all these things and going, that is not at all how time travel would work. And of course we're just talking hypothesis here, but it's also one of those like, a lot of Back to the Future is flawed when you start looking at
that. And even with like the Avengers, so they had the glowing blue cube that they called a Tesseract, and it's like, that's not what a Tesseract is, but okay, you're using the term, so that's
I know. Yeah. That was the first thing I said too, was that's not a Tesseract at all.
It's not a Tesseract. Interstellar had at least a much better idea of a Tesseract, and they did a great job with that, and they had Kip Thorne, one of the physicists I mentioned earlier. They had him as a consultant on that film, and so their idea of the Tesseract there was this whole huge world, essentially, where Cooper's in there, and they have every moment of his daughter's bedroom there, every single moment, and they don't know what the right moment is. He has to go find it, but he's able to access every moment like, you know, it's three-dimensional space.
Yeah. Yeah. And that idea of being able to manipulate time, that idea of being able to once again, if we get close to the speed of light, we can begin to manipulate time all day, all kinds of things. But we would have to get close to the speed of light, which is at least by our current technology almost impossible. Either that or have a massive gravitational field of some sort, some way to be able to actively warp the fabric of time and space as we know it.
Yeah, there's a scientist out there, and I forget his name off the top of my head. I empathize with him because his father passed away when he was young, and so he's been trying to figure out ways to travel through time, basically, you know, spend more time with his father. I get it. It's sad. And his ideas center around, you know, slingshotting around a black hole, which, you know, a black hole does bend space and time, or at least time as we conceive it here in this dimension. It's an interesting ideas about how that would work, such as the black hole, if you were able to slingshot around it, would only be able to take you back to the point in time in which it was created. So in other words, if you wanted to go back to the time of the dinosaurs, but this black hole was created, we'll say 5 million years ago or whatever, dinosaurs went extinct 64 million years ago, you wouldn't be able to take it back to the time of dinosaurs. You can only take it back 5 million years, which is, you know, interesting. And I guess theoretically, maybe that's true.
To the point of warp of that point in space time.
Right. Exactly. A lot of issues with it, though. For one, the closest black hole from us is over 1,000 light years away. You know, we're not getting to there anytime soon.
No.
You know, and the amount of time it'll take you to get there and come back, you know, is, you know, all that time would have been spent anyway. But also, when you get to the black hole, you know, the gravitational pull is so strong that even if you didn't somehow pass in over the event horizon, get lost into the black hole, the gravitational pull is so strong that you'd go through this process called spaghettification, in which it would, like, you know, basically pull you apart like a string of spaghetti, which is
into a string of individual atoms.
Yeah. So both your craft and you would be obliterated. So, you know, it's kind of irrelevant to even think about how we could use a black hole to travel through time.
Well, and yeah, I mean, coming off that slingshot concept, I guess from the way that we've recovered spacecraft in the past, things like that.
It's using that, like, you know, the way that, you know, we've gone around the moon or, you know, other objects around space, and how we've moved satellites through the solar system and things like that. We do that.
And you know, we definitely know now that there are interstellar superhighways, that there are like massive tunnels that are hyperdrive highways, basically, within our solar system, and they connect our solar system to the sun, to all other points and other points within the known galaxy and beyond.
I mean, my whole platform is the connected universe, and a lot of my imagery that I use for, like, my branding, they're probably gonna nail me one of these days for it. So the Chandra X-ray telescope about 15 years ago took this fantastic image of the universe, and it's, when you look at it, you know, it's like this whole kind of, because of the way they colorize it, this whole purplish background, and you see these yellow and orange dots, and they're all strung together with, like, this fibrous, almost spiderwebby sort of material. You're looking at it like, what in the world's that? It's actually an image of the universe. And each of those yellow and orange dots are galaxies. And those spiderwebby strings, those are all gaseous filaments that are connecting the galaxies together. So when we say we're all connected, it's not just, you know, metaphysical woo woo sort of thing, although we are all connected.
Physically,
we are connected to the rest of the universe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's a point that I bring up regularly. Like, one of the only classes I made better than C's in, Mike, was science ever. Yeah. I always made A's in science. And as I remember distinctly ninth grade science, the fact that we are 90% empty space.
Yeah.
That my electron shell extends for hundreds and hundreds. Like, I'm sharing an electron shell with my brother in Houston right now. We're commingling. You know, the only thing is that quantum field that's holding me together, that causes this repulsion of electrons that makes me feel this table. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, the table doesn't actually exist. It's just an assemblage of electrons that are repulsing against mine.
Yeah, it seems solid, but it's really not.
Yeah. And even the idea of being able to, like, drop this crystal on my desk, but the fact that by all real physics, you could divide that distance in half infinitely. Mm-hmm. And no, it never actually touches the desk.
It never touches it, yeah.
There are all kinds of principles out there that are actual real things that tie to this in a very, very interesting way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if you could figure out the proper, you know, frequency and vibration of that table and somehow synchronize the atoms in your hand with that of the table, you could pass your hand right through it.
Absolutely. And, yeah. And you know, in the last few minutes, let's get into how these phenomena, because that brings up literally a story that I heard from Kathleen Martin at one point on my show. Then all of a month later, heard from Hal Puthoff about the same case at the International Remote Viewing Association. And that was somebody who was near a craft, went to touch the craft, and their hand passed through it.
Okay.
And they were inside of the craft. And the whole idea of vibration, the yeah. idea that is, do we need a physical craft in that kind of way? And the answer is absolutely not. You know,
no, we don't. Although I do believe physical craft have
most definitely
come here, yeah. But I believe a lot of the different things that we are seeing and experiencing are what you might call interdimensional in nature. Yeah. When we talk about some of these beings, rather than extraterrestrials, they are probably ultra-terrestrial, so other beings and things that are alongside yeah. of us that are in another dimension. And it's just, yeah, again, you know, that frequency, resonance, energy, vibration yeah. that's coming from another dimension that it's, you know, we, again, we're talking about our experience here, and we don't have the really the proper geometry to see those other dimensions properly. You know, our eyes, you know, only take in a very, very narrow band of the spectrum of light. So what we're seeing and observing here is very, very small compared to what all is out there. So, yeah, when people have these experiences of passing into these other realms, I mean, it's a rare moment. So we call it supernatural and all yeah. that, but it's really part of the natural world. It's not sure. really supernatural, other than the fact it's not something we normally experience. So, yeah, a lot of these, you know, extraterrestrial stories of, you know, missing time or going into, you know, the spaceships and the mothership, yeah. you know, right here on Earth. They're very, very similar. Jacques Vallée did a lot of research on this. Very yep. similar to stories from the past, like fairy experiences that people had back in the 1700s and 1800s, where they were being taken into these other realms and missing time and these sorts yeah. of things. I just think that there were other dimensions beyond ours that they had the opportunity to, or something was imparted to them by those other dimensional beings to make that experience happen for them.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, Dr. Michael P. Masters, I love his work. He's yeah. an anthropologist, but he has posited the hypothesis that perhaps at least many of these visitations that we have, especially from extraterrestrials, when you start listening to their questions that they ask people, when they start when you start listening to the warnings that they give people, like take care of your planet, you know, don't play around with nuclear things, stuff like that, he projects out the fact that if you look at the evolution of humanity, the way that we have evolved, gotten skinnier, our heads bigger, things like that, that if you project humanity out by 10,000 years, we kind of start to look like the Greys a little bit. And it may very well be the fact that many of these things are almost us trying to come back and decode what happened.
They could be.
You know.
And they could be, and when we talk like the gray aliens, I mean, they could be, it could be ancestors of ours. Yeah. We've descended from this, or they could be, you know, us in the future and these sorts of things. When people ask me, or throw out there, because there are some people in the field that are just adamant that every single extraterrestrial experience is an experience with just us from the future. Like, they're yes. not extraterrestrials. They're just us. And yeah. it's like, well, it could be us from the future. Yeah, I'll give you that. But that doesn't mean they all are, because yes. there's a lot of different things that can happen over that time. Again, you take the dinosaurs went extinct 64 million years ago. Well, that's just over this about a percentage and a half of the lifespan of the Earth ago. You know, Earth is about yeah. 4.5 billion years old, and 1.5% of that ago, the dinosaurs went extinct. So a lot can happen. So 64 million years from now, another percentage and a half of the time the Earth is going to be here, are we still going to be around?
Yeah.
We might not be. We may have, you know, annihilated ourselves by now, or made the planet uninhabitable for us, so we had to leave. But another intelligent life form could have evolved and built their civilization, everything. And maybe they discovered, you know, time travel technology and went back in time, or could actually be extraterrestrials from the future that, again, maybe we were gone. We weren't around anymore and found our planet. They're like, oh, that's habitable for us. Colonized, developed their civilization, developed time travel technology and went back. So, yeah, could be other life forms that are earthbound in the future, whether that's one that evolved here or extraterrestrials that colonized here in the future. Yeah. There's a lot of different possibilities.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, like we say all the time, I have a rote phrase that I use, Mike, and that's, I firmly believe that there is a large hominid being roaming the woods of North America and beyond, known as Sasquatch. But I also think that there is something else that is fully willing to use the trope of our minds as a point of entry, as that point of consent by which to, whether you want to call it enter this dimension, whatever. So the idea that I believe that quite a few of these things on all fronts paranormally are much more an interdimensional slip.
Yeah, it's something that's a little bit beyond our normal understanding and grasp of the universe. That, you know, we call it, and, you know, even like with our physicists, you know, they debate and bicker over how many other dimensions there are. Are there really only 11? Are there more than that? You know, even the age of the planet. And I was saying, well, it might actually be double that. It might not be, you know, 13.5 billion years old. It might be closer to 27 billion. So, you know, they're always disagreeing too on this. Well, and I think there's just, you know, a lot more that we still need to learn about our universe, and we're trying to put the pieces together. So, yeah, these are ideas and concepts that I have now that I write books about, that 20 years down the road, I mean, a lot of it's probably going to be incorrect at that point. I'll have to write another book. Well, you know?
The thing is, though, this is where we get quantum physics from, Mike. Mm-hmm. This is like, people forget the fact that quantum physics, most of physics came from pure thought experiment.
Yeah.
You know, and somebody was like, hey, this is kind of what I came up with in the lab in my head. Go through my math. Go through my concept here with a fine tooth comb. Tell me what you think. To the point that, like, even when Einstein released his equation, there were a couple issues with it. You know?
Oh, yeah. Well, and Einstein wasn't the greatest mathematician.
No.
He hired guys out for that.
Yeah. He whiffed that plate a few times, man, just swinging at the bottle and totally missing. I just watched a great, great courses series about him, and my son was watching it with me. He's 8, and he's like, isn't Einstein like one of the smartest people in the in the world? And I'm like, well, sure, but it doesn't mean he wasn't wrong.
Right.
Doesn't mean he didn't get it wrong.
Yeah.
And that's the beautiful thing about science, is that's why it's in a circle, the scientific method, because it never stops. It never stops. We will always be finding out new data. And that's why I kind of have problems, to loop this back to the beginning of the conversation, Mike. That's why I have problems with some of traditional Egyptology, because, you know, hey, science is supposed to move. It's supposed to flex. You know, you're supposed to be able to relook at a hypothesis and gather new data from it, or even go, you know, hypothesis doesn't hold water anymore, and move forward.
Yeah,
science.
Right. Yeah. You can't take something that you've discovered and just try to cram it into your narrative. If it doesn't fit, it doesn't fit. And somewhere the narrative needs to change a little bit. And so, yeah, you have to be open-minded when it comes to all that, that there's, you know, that there's always going to be new ideas out there, new discoveries. And, you know, something I like to say is, because a lot of people, when, you know, we talk about stargates, when we talk about time travel, when we talk about a lot of these things that we're discovering in Egypt, and we're making the connection to stargates and all that, a lot of people say, well, this is just, you know, pseudoscience nonsense. Well, today's science was the pseudoscience back then.
That's right.
And so our pseudoscience now is going to be the science of the future. And we're just, you know, we're just that stepping stone for the next generation.
Yeah, no, I mean, all of 500 years ago, the Earth was still flat.
Right.
And to say otherwise was an excommunicatable or burnable offense. Or
burnable offense,
straight burnable. You would be set on fire in the public square and made an example of. Within the last 100 years, we started washing our hands before surgery. because we figured out that, you know, it wasn't just four volatile substances in our body, like phlegm and ether and bile, that made us operate, that there were tiny little critters that made us sick inside. Mm-hmm. You know, like this is science. But before then, there was tons of other science, right? You know, that was like that was literally fighting against the fact of no, what you're talking, bacteria don't exist. You're a crazy person. There was tons of science, like actual founded science, saying no to that.
Right.
So science has to fight tooth and nail.
Over the years. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. And when you start getting into the realms of time travel, when you start talking about literally modern day alchemy, like CERN and things like that, that are changing the way that we look at reality, period, changing the way that we look at the physical universe and our interaction with it. It's amazing and beautiful stuff.
All of that neutrino research that came out of Antarctica a few years back, you know, you had the scientists, a peer-reviewed published paper, actually likening what they had discovered down there to a parallel universe running in reverse time. These are the scientists saying that,
yeah.
You know, which of course catches my eyes, like, wow, that's amazing. But they're taking it a step further now. Okay, that came out of just neutrino research that they were doing. Now they're actually actively trying to do things with neutrinos. So they grabbed some old gold mines in South Dakota, retrofitted them with all this equipment. And in Chicago, in Fermilab, they're shooting neutrinos through the Earth 800 miles to this other facility that they've built out there in South Dakota to study matter and antimatter, which is really fascinating. So they're actually studying duality here after they had just discovered all of these things down in Antarctica, or the parallel universe or in reverse time. That would mean duality. So now matter and antimatter, that's duality. Yeah. So they're putting the pieces together, and it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Well, and once again, it's amazing research. I love what you've done with Travels Through Time.
Thank
it's
you.
Fantastic. It is a really, really great conglomeration of all of these concepts, and the idea of stack time, like you said, a stack of pictures or leaves in a book, is really phenomenal. I want to thank you, as always, for your time, Mike. Let everybody know where they can go to get not only Travels Through Time, but the other books that you have, Mike.
Yeah, absolutely. The latest is Portals to the Stars, which is the second part. This is the Connecting the Universe series. And you can find those and all my other books, MikeRicksecker.com. There you go. And you can jump on my YouTube for all the latest that I'm doing out there. Of course, I'm all over social media. I have my own platform, which is the connectuniverseportal.com. And then, Alaska's Mysterious Triangle. We got Walk in the Shadows. And then 10 others after that, too. So
Wow. Absolutely awesome, man. Well, once again, as always, thank you so much. I'll be sharing links, all that kind of good stuff.
Appreciate
once
it.
Things finish out tonight. Take care of yourself, Mike, and we'll talk to you soon.
Have a great night.
Absolutely. While you are online checking out everything from MikeRicksecker.com, everybody, make sure to stop on by Amazon, grab his book, Travels Through Time, Inside the Fourth Dimension, Time and a Stacked Time Theory, Connecting the Universe. You can also find that and all of the books from our guests, as well as videos, classes, and more at curiousrealm.com/store. When we come back from this quick commercial break, we will be joined by our good friend Ryan Edwards. We will be talking about cryptid cats in North America and beyond. I will be sharing my cryptid cat story, which is literally the only cryptid story I personally have, as far as personal experience. So we'll be getting into that and more right after this, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick break. Thank you so much for staying tuned. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you're a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science make some amazing products using a spigyric process. They use every part of the hemp plant, the seeds, the stems, the roots, the buds, the leaves. Every part of the plant is used, reused, combusted, and reused, and that process followed until an amazing spigyric product is the result, complete with terpene profiles and all. Stop on by and check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. Our guest in this segment is the amazing Ryan Edwards. We will be talking about cryptid cats. Welcome back to the show, Ryan. How are you doing, my friend?
Always good to be on.
Absolutely, man. Always great to have you on. This is a topic that is near and dear to my heart, Ryan. I've talked about my experience. This is one of the only cryptid experience that I have, as far as I know. And it's not Bigfoot or anything like that, but this is why I say all the time, I will believe the experiencer until proven otherwise, because I've had my own. And, my aunt at one point, who lived in Louisiana, was dating one of the chiefs of the Coushatta Indian tribe. And we went, spent a weekend with the family at the Coushatta Ranch in Louisiana. And while sitting around the campfire, I got up, turned around, and walking down the dirt road was a mountain lion. And I don't mean like, hey, look at that cat, or, ooh, there's a really big golden retriever. This was a effing mountain lion walking down the dirt road behind the cars. Wow. And I said something, and people are like, and I mean, hey, people are known I'm prone to a little bit of reefer. People are known I'm prone to a drink here and there, Ryan. However, I was like, I'm telling you what I just saw, and it was that. And now there are many sightings of mountain lions in East Texas, you know, things like that. That led me down the road of proving this, like, for some reason, feeling like I needed to prove my experience to somebody to begin with. But it also led me down the road of finding out about the Jaguarundi, which is one of Texas's own cats. This thing is apparently not extinct in Texas, once thought to be extinct here, but not extinct. Ranges everywhere from Mexico to coastal Texas to East Texas, even into Louisiana. So,
yeah.
And many say it is one of the reasons that the Houston Cougars are named for what they are, is the Jaguarundi and the spottings of them on Buffalo Bayou, things like that along Houston. So, let's get into cryptid cats, man. How did you first come to the research of cryptid cats to begin with?
Well, really what it was is just I always see myself as like a generalist cryptozoologist. I don't just study Bigfoot or Dogman. I study a little bit of everything. And one of the cryptozoologists I really look towards in my research is Dr. Carl Shuker. And Shuker's book, Ghost Cats, and his research into unknown felines really led me to the research of like, hey, notice, weirdly, a lot of feline cats that are cryptids around the world, especially here in Texas. We have a lot of Black Panther sightings here in Texas.
Yep.
Like, it's funny, when I'm driving in East Texas, I always see the town of Palestine, the Palestine cat. Back, I think it was like 2006, 2000, like early 2000s. Supposedly, the story goes, on this fence line in Palestine, Texas, there was this big black cat body that was found. And people would always drive by it, and all the locals were like, yeah, there's just black cats that live out in the woods. And initially, it's such a mystery because a lot of people say, oh, well, these are just melanistic cougars. But it has been proven that the melanistic gene does not exist within Felis concula, or the mountain lion. So what are these cats? And in looking in the books of like Dr. Lauren Coleman, from Lauren Coleman, from other researchers like Bernard Huvelmans, you see other like these big black cats, these Panthera atrox, they like to call it. These giant unknown cats seen around the United States and around the world as well. Like, for instance, some researchers still think the American lions might still exist into the modern day in North America. I'm not a big supporter of that just because how large that animal was. But also my interest in prehistory really brought into it because, for instance, the Eneti tiger in Africa. The Eneti tiger on the Eneti Valley was described as a lion but with a short tail, a sloped back, and large teeth coming out of its mouth, like long fangs. If you look at that description, you're pretty much talking about a Smilodon fatalis or some type of Machairodine, these saber-toothed cats. And that brings into even more research, like, are there maybe saber-toothed cats still surviving into the modern day? And other prehistoric felines that were presumed extinct, including even ones that were once found in the range, like, for instance, the jaguar. Like, we know there's, right now, researchers estimate there's probably 8 to 10 jaguars that are living in Arizona. Most of them are very much large home ranges, but people don't realize that the jaguar existed everywhere from Arizona all the way up into the Washington State back in the Pleistocene. It wasn't until like the 1960s that the last jaguars were killed in North America because of Europeans entering the continent.
Yeah.
So that's even a cryptid in and of itself, is maybe some of these Black Panther sightings are jaguars.
Well, and you know, that the idea that I've been bringing up the articles about the Arizona jaguar that literally just posted all of a week or so ago before we recorded this. And these are things that are, once again, regular, that are starting to happen in Arizona, where these sightings are much, much more common. And they go back for a while, you know, and it took a long time for there to be trail cams, security cams, that kind of stuff, that actively started catching them on a regular basis. So how do we... Now, especially when it comes to cryptozoology, most things begin with story. They begin with local folklore, things like that. So the idea that people had talked about these in local tradition, at least back a generation or so, is not that crazy, and once again proven now. So what other examples do we have here in the United States of things like that?
Well, one big thing is not just the Black Panthers. One other cryptic feline that's really not talked about nowadays is the Anza. The Anza originates from Aztec folklore. The Anza was supposedly a golden cat that was as large as a mountain lion but with a golden color. And that was as fierce as a jaguar, they would say. Supposedly, Montezuma had an Anza within his own zoo in the Aztec capital. And when the conquistadors came over, they said they found this Anza. And the Anza was much more fierce than like the mod, than the actual like indigenous cats in the region. But Anza sightings have really died out since, I think, early 1900s. So a lot of these examples, if you look back in history, maybe these are cat, these were felines that were found here in North America and that have gone extinct since. Like, some researchers believe the Anza might have been a subspecies of a mountain lion or maybe a subspecies of a jaguar. It's funny because the modern jaguar, Felis Anza Anza, Anza originally originates from the name Anza, O-N-Z-A. But jaguars, their scientific name is Panthera Anza, O-N-C-A. So you literally have kind of a cryptid living within a known species. And you have a lot of examples like that, especially here in North America. You have a lot of unknown felines, but I think the biggest one here would be the Panthera atrox, these unknown black cats seen around the country. Because if you look at it, these sightings originate all the way from the West Coast all the way to the East Coast. And one example of a cryptid that not a lot of people think about is the Eastern Cougar.
Yeah.
Like, supposedly, according to zoologists, there's no cougars east of the Mississippi. But you go to Pennsylvania, Vermont, parts of even North South Carolina, the sightings of these mountain lions. So not a lot of people, when people think of cryptozoology, they immediately think of sea serpents, Nessie, Bigfoot. But one big thing of cryptozoology is animals outside of their natural ranges. The Eastern Cougar is a great example of this. It's possibly these are cougars that are entering into regions that they were once found in, because cougars were once found along the eastern seaboard, but due to Europeans, they were mostly killed out until they're east of the Mississippi. Even back in the day in Texas here, supposedly for the longest time, like, for instance, here in San Antonio, up in north of San Antonio, there were sightings of mountain lions, but a lot of biologists say there's no mountain lions in South Texas. Until only a couple of years ago, they admitted, yeah, there's mountain lions in here, in this region now. But
yeah,
they were literally sighted years before they were ever officially determined to be here by officials, like actual zoologists. So that can even be an example of like a cryptid, like of the Eastern Cougar entering regions that they were once found in. Just like how the jaguar modern day is moving into regions they were once found in. It's kind of like an idea like rewilding, like predators that were found in a region now re-entering it after a while. Like, for instance, wolves. Wolves have been introduced into areas that they were once found in. Like,
yeah,
there's wolves being reintroduced into northern Mexico, because northern Mexico, you literally had jaguars, mountain lions, black bears, wolves, and even Mexican grizzly bears. So you see this like rewilding campaign that kind of goes hand in hand with cryptozoology, because a lot of these ideas are stories and sightings of these creatures before you ever reintroduce them or officially say that they're there. Just because maybe one gets hit by a car, or just because the amount of sightings, officials have to admit that the mountain lions or these other creatures are in the region. Like you brought up with a jaguar. Stories of jaguars in Arizona and parts of the Southwest have been going back for generations, but they were just stories until, I think it was 1996, the first ever jaguar was sighted in Arizona. I think El Jefe. It was the first ever jaguar I've seen. So, okay, now we have the evidence to back up the stories.
Yeah. Yeah. And once again, I'll pop this map up again from American Scientist, folks, about mountain lions in the, and if you notice that whole left side of the United States, pretty much from West Texas over, through the Colorado Rockies, everything else, that is known cougar range. So when you start looking from Central Texas, up and over, you got a lot of sightings of cougars, man. And yeah, you know, there's like a one-off, but There's areas with 2, 5, some of them 16 to 50, some of them 51 to 100 sightings, you know. So when you start thinking about the idea of, A, cats don't really herd like that. Like mountain, like lions do. Tigers are social when they see each other or meet each other. You know, they won't really mess around with each other too much. But aside from that, they have crossing territories, that kind of stuff. And even if you want a good example in a micro size, folks, feel free to like GPS your cat if it's an outdoor cat and watch that thing. Because over a week, you will see your cat range for like a mile or so, you know, and you he goes a couple fences over, you know, I know a couple neighbors down the road have seen it. Like, no, your cat, once it has a range, that home range is miles in radius. It's a good 3 mile swath for the average house cat. So when you get into an actual and active predatory situation of hunting grounds and things like that, as opposed to the sociability of house cats, where they've kind of been bred to be in groups, things like that. Mountain lions are not like that. Tigers aren't like that. Jaguars aren't like that. They're like that when they are breeding and brooding. But aside from that, they don't really hang out in groups in that kind of way.
Yeah. It's like, though, what I always tell people, animals don't believe in borders and stuff like that. Yeah. Like, just because, this is a mountain lion, this isn't where on the map mountain lions are found, doesn't mean a mountain lion's not going to enter that area. Like, there's a lot of these creatures, a lot of these animals that go outside of their natural ranges. And it's funny because if you look at where a lot of these cougar sightings, you also get these Black Panther sightings. Yeah. So some people think, well, if this is a population of cougars, could these be mountainous to cougars? I don't personally think so, but think about it. If a known cat species can survive here, so can an unknown cat species, because they might be going after the same prey items, going after the same areas. Like, what I think is this, like, when it comes to these unknown black cat sightings in North America, what I personally think they are is I think they might be jaguars that were from prehistoric times, because during the Pleistocene, these jaguars that are found in North America were actually a subspecies of the ones found currently in South America and the Southwest. They're a little bit larger, and there's a possibility that maybe these became mountainistic over time. Because think, if you're a black cat, you don't get seen as much. So maybe because that black pattern is more sufficient to survive, maybe it was more selected for with those genes.
Yeah.
So maybe it's a possibility that maybe a lot of these Black Panther sightings throughout the United States are actually surviving jaguars. Another example, like for instance, we brought up with a Jaguarundi. Some people also think maybe some of these Black Panther sightings, especially here in Texas and parts of Louisiana, because parts of East Texas might be Jaguarundis, because Jaguarundis aren't the largest cat, but a lot of times if it's nighttime, darker, not a lot of people are exactly trained observers.
They're big enough.
You might think a little bit larger than it actually is. Yeah. Like, it's always a fishing story. Like, I caught a fish that was this big. Even though it's this big, you caught it and it was this big. That idea.
Yeah. Well, and once again, moments like that, you are typically adrenalized. You're normally going to see something like this close to nighttime because they aren't necessarily daytime hunters in that kind of way. It's much more early morning, dusk, things like that. But once again, a Jaguarundi isn't a small critter. Even a weasel is pretty dang big. Even a river otter is pretty big. A Jaguarundi ranges and goes almost to the size of a good size big cocker spaniel.
Yeah.
You know,
they even get, They gave them, some people even say they get the size of like a, almost an ocelot. Like they get fairly large, especially if it's in an area that's very plentiful with game. Like look at East Texas, look at parts of even parts of South Texas. There's a lot of game out there, especially game large enough that they can take down, like rabbits, things like that, that they can get fairly large.
And can I just give a shout out to friends real quick? Because when you search Jaguarundi in images, 3-4 down right there, bam! There's our boy Chester Moore with How You're Calling Wildlife.
Yeah.
I love it. But yeah, so it's one of those, there are numerous options out there. And yes, a Jaguarundi could definitely be melanistic, things like that. But that doesn't normally run in Cougarville, so to speak.
Yeah.
So the idea of Black Panther sightings, the idea, and even Chester, as I popped up on screen a while ago, had an article about Black Panthers. We had had him on chatting about that at one point. And the idea of most of these would probably be misidentifications of something along the lines of a melanistic Jaguarundi or something like that.
Yeah. Well, even some people, like when you look at like a lot of these videos of Black Panthers on YouTube and stuff like that, you can literally look at it and you're like, no, that's just a large house cat. Like a lot of people might look at a large house cat and be like, oh, that's some type of giant Black Panther. But you look at it closer, see the pointed ears, see how the tail is. It's a little bit shorter than a wildcat's tail. So, yeah, that's just a misidentification of a known species. Like, that's one big thing, too, is misidentifications of known animals, is especially with cats. Because with cats, I don't know, there's like a, it's almost like this innate fear when it comes to humans. Like, especially with, like, black cats. Like, think, how many stories go back when demonic cats are always like giant black cats? And it's kind of funny because you see this throughout not just North America, but even parts of like Europe. Like you see the Beast of Exmoor, Beast of Bodmin Moor, these big black cats seen in Europe as well. So you see this kind of seeing a large black cat at night is what make you think, even if it's a house cat, it might turn it into a Black Panther or something like that, just from this kind of ideology around us.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that brings us to one of the things that you and I talk about regularly, Ryan, which is the way our brains process things, the way that we put things together, to create a narrative, even from very short pieces of data, even from very small pieces of data, our brain wants to create a larger story that it can comprehend and understand.
Yeah.
So.
And it's funny, like, for instance, like, a lot of it might just be, like, psychosomatic. One group of cryptid felines, though, that I know is not psychosomatic are these British big cats that we just brought up. Because if you look at the British big cat phenomena, especially into the modern day, a lot more officials are really bringing it up, saying, well, maybe there is something going on here. Because just the amount of sightings and also livestock depredations that's been going on down there, going on over there. You have the Surrey Puma that was first seen in the 50s. Then you had the Beast of Bodmin Moor that was much more during the 70s, 80s. Now you have the Beast of Exmoor. And what a lot of people think, what I think as well, is that these were big cats that were released during the big cat craze during the 70s.
Yep.
It became illegal to own big cats in Great Britain. They were probably released into the wild areas and found an environment that they were able to actually adapt to and survive it due to livestock, sheep, cows, things like that, and also big expansive areas. So this is almost an example of not really an invasive species, because if you look at Great Britain, not nowadays, it doesn't have any large extant predators. Older predators were killed out hundreds of thousands of years ago. These animals have found a niche that is still there, but it doesn't have any animals living in it currently.
So,
an example of like almost like a rewilding, you might say. Not by like they weren't planning it, but these big black cats, these big cats, because even you see puma sightings out in Great Britain.
Sure.
Like regular black, not just black cats, but also like regular, like mountain lions.
But wouldn't
found
that,
a niche that they can use into the modern day.
Well, wouldn't that have to belie a breeding population, though, Ryan? Because, I mean, while the average house cat, don't get me wrong, can, because of its sheltered life, because of specialized diet, because of just general love and affection, which helps us all live longer, as we know by science, literally. The average house cat has a lifespan of 13 to 30 years, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, feel free to just Google that, folks. You'll see that pop right up. However, when you're talking about larger cats, when you're talking about cats in the wild, things like that, you're talking much more of a 15-year range, you know? So the idea of still having sightings from cats that, like, you would have to have a breeding population.
Which, it's funny because there have been sightings in parts of Great Britain of kittens. People have seen these, it looks like almost like a, they say like almost like a lion kitten, or like it's a kitten, but it's not a, you can't, you can tell it's not a, like a household cat. Mm. So it is suggested that there might be a, maybe not a large population, but a small population of breeding large cats in Great Britain into the modern day because of wild releases. Even looking here in Texas.
Like, oh, yeah, absolutely.
Well, listen, Texas has not a lot of laws on exotic animals. Like, I think I remember hearing that there's more tigers in Texas than there are in India.
I would not doubt that.
Yeah, how many collectors are here? And how many times have they gone, been released or have gotten loose that we don't know about?
Yeah.
Great story I always like to tell about is a mutual friend, Tex Wesson, up in southern Oklahoma. When he was up there, we know that there are multiple tigers released into the area that he does his research. And
oh, wow.
One day he was walking on a path at night and he literally heard a growl that sounded like it was from a big, big cat. And he thought, wait, no, yeah, I think it was a tiger king had a property out there, and he released a bunch of big cats.
Oh, wow.
So we noticed big cats out there, and there's been no sightings since. So that tells you if a tiger can hide out there, cats are really good at hiding. Like,
yeah.
They're known for being very cryptic in and of themselves.
Wow. Wow. And yeah, you know, I mean, I've just brought up a tiger loose in South Texas from the San Antonio, from my San Antonio. So that was all of last year. These things happen. They get out. My God, my dad told me a story. It was hilarious. My dad telling me a cryptid story. It was so great. I was like, whoa, hold on. Like, I need a fresh beer for this. But my stepmother, whose cousin was out hunting and out on a buddy's property, stuff like that. They were just out hog hunting, that kind of stuff. He was in the blind and thought he heard something messing around. Was like, hey, you know, we're hunting in here. Like, be careful. You know, just letting you know there's armed individuals in here. And the thing kept messing around. Before he knew it, an arm literally reached around, a huge hairy arm reached around and grabbed him inside of the deer blind. It was an orangutan.
Wow.
That had gotten loose from somebody's enclosure and was loose out in the wild in the woods. So, you know, these things do happen. They get out all the time. And who do you report it to? You know, I mean, you really ain't supposed to have an orangutan, you know, as a pet. Like, there was a day and time when, yes, you could. But when those laws stop, what happens to them? You know, like, this is literally how you end up with stories of alligators growing in the sewers, Ryan.
Yeah. Or even like, I've talked to Justin Moore about this, is literally here in parts of South Texas, there is a population of monkeys. I believe they're macaques that were released, and they are literally surviving into the modern day in South Texas. I think it's called Monkey Island out in Florida. It was a bunch of, I think, macaques that were used for a research center. And then when Katrina and other hurricanes came through, released all the monkeys, and they're literally surviving nowadays in Florida. And it's a known tourist area that tourists go down and check these monkeys out living out in these swamps. So a lot of times, a lot of these exotic animals are released or either purposefully or by accident. And especially with that orangutan story, orangutans are known escape artists. Like, there are certain stories, and a lot of zookeepers say, not a lot of zoos keep orangutans because how good they are with their hands. They're really good at watching humans, learning from them, and knowing how to use tools. Like, I believe there's one certain orangutan, I think it was in the LA Zoo, he got out literally four different times because when he was being raised as an infant, he was raised around humans. He learned how to use like wrenches and stuff. So when someone would drop a tool into the enclosure, no one would think about it. He would grab it and use it to literally get out of the enclosure.
Yeah. Yeah. And there it is. Fu Manchu. The clever escape. Like actively figured out how to open enclosures and everything else. And you know, when you think about that, and especially when you think about released animals breeding in the wild, because of course there's lynx, there's servals, there's all kinds of wild cats in Britain. What would the odds of a big cat being able to breed with a local population of something like that? Would that be possible biologically?
Biologically, wouldn't they be likely? Because even let's just say if they did an inbreed and caused some type of, let's say, hybrid offspring, when most aspects of, like, especially hybrids, are usually sterile. So if, let's just say in Great Britain, if there was known big cats getting released, there would have to be like two or three like leopards or two or three mountain lions, something like that, of the same species interbreeding. Because let's just say someone released a lion and a tiger and we had a liger out there, I'm pretty sure we would know about that because just how large those cats would get. Like literally ligers get the size of like the largest known cat to ever exist from prehistory or the modern day. So interbreeding is very unlikely, but it does happen. Like, for instance, one big thing I'm getting brought up, a lot of people brought up to me recently, is these cats in Australia. Have you heard about how feral cats in Australia are literally becoming kind of a new species in and of themselves? Like, these feral cats in Australia become much larger than any other feral cats. They literally get the size of like ocelots and the size of like jaguarundis. Wow. And some people think these black panther sightings that happen in Australia might be these giant feral cats that are happening in Australia because they're going after the native species that aren't really built to defend themselves against cats, and they get gigantic down there. So you literally see almost before our eyes a new species evolving due to the environment they're found in.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, that specialization can take millennia, or it can happen really rapidly. It's fascinating how fast that happens. One of the things I talk about all the time is how fast a domestic pig will genetically revert to boar. And it's like within a generation. Yeah. Like if a pig gets out and breaks its pen, gets out into the wild, within weeks, it will start growing coarse hair. It will start growing tusks. And every piglet that it has will be like a wild boar.
Yeah.
Or like a pickery hog, like what we have here, you know.
Yeah. Well, another thing I like to bring up is that probably in high school or middle school when people are learning about evolution and adaptations, they're probably taught about the peppered moth. These were moths that were found in Great Britain during the Industrial Revolution, and due to the soot being put on the out of local woods and local area, these moths literally within a couple years went from a light gray to almost a black to match the soot that was found in the area. So you literally see these adaptations can occur very rapidly when it needs to. Insects, especially because how quick the generations are, but case-selected species or species that breed very quickly, adaptations can occur very rapidly with these animals. Because of how quickly the generations occur. If you have a quick generation, you can have a quick adaptation. And even in environments that, let's just say, there's an apex predator and it's really thriving, yeah, these adaptations can occur very quickly that we don't really realize it. Like, people think of adaptations and evolution as having rapidly over millennia. Yes, to an extent, that occurs, but there has been examples of rapid evolution and rapid adaptation in the past.
Well, and that's just it. That specialization of species happens pretty quick, especially when you're talking about the reintroduction of something. You know, it's been interesting, as we've talked about before. I want to say last time we had you on, we were talking about Colossal Biosciences and the whole idea of reintroducing species into areas and the way that it can stabilize or destabilize an environment, you know, and it's one thing to reintroduce something like the red wolf back to Yellowstone, you know, where they'd been hunted out, things like that. And now you start having problems like Lyme disease and stuff like that, where the only way that you can control the population of deer, elk, that kind of stuff on a proper basis is through mass hunting and licensing of permits and so many tags per year and things like that. Because, well, we hunted the apex predators out. Well, once we started bringing them in, those things started declining.
Yeah.
You know, and it's interesting to see how populations have stabilized in that kind of way.
Yeah, no, it's like, it's funny when talking about this, like what we were talking about earlier with the jaguars, for instance. Like, a lot of locals in Arizona have talked about these jaguars saying, well, they'll hunt my cattle, they'll kill my livestock, stuff like that. And as to my knowledge, there's not many examples of livestock depredation. But these are literally predators that they talk about, well, they weren't here. Well, yes, they were once here. They just weren't here in your generation.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of these wild cats are going into their own home environments that they were once found in. But due to hunting and due to habitat loss, they're no longer found nowadays. But the environment is still there for the animal, but just that humans have entered that environment that cause it to not want to be there anymore. But now with them moving back into it, of course, humans have that idea of like, I want to push against it. I want to push against it. Like, for instance, you're talking about Yellowstone. When they introduced a gray wolf back to Yellowstone, a lot of ranchers hated the idea because they thought these wolves would go after their cattle, kill their sheep, things like that. But it is a keystone species that ultimately helps the environment completely. And a lot of big cats do that. Like, for instance, mountain lions, they're keystone species all the way from here up into, all the way down into the pampas of South America. Like, they help out the environment completely, especially large cats.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, because, And that's something that we try and explain to people whenever I talk at conferences, whenever I speak on other shows. It's the idea of, if you are a fan of cryptozoology, I don't care if it's the Loveland Frogman that you're about. I don't care if you're about the Gugway or Dogman or Bigfoot, whatever. Buddy, you better get into friggin' conservancy. You better get into wildlife conservancy and understanding wildlife conservancy, not only in your localized area, but in the area that your favorite cryptid lives in. Because if that goes away, so goes the cryptid. Like, either that or you're going to have Bigfoot rooting through the trash of your local apartment complex like we have brown bears doing. Yeah. You know?
It's also funny because with me, I do a lot of research into, like, a lot of these older cryptids, the cryptids referenced by, like, Bernard Hoovermans, things like that.
Sure.
And if you look at a lot of sightings, like, for instance, the Morosi, the spotted lion of Kenya, sighting stopped after the 1970s. The Anetti tiger of parts of eastern Africa, sighting stopped after the 1980s. How many of these cryptids are not seen nowadays? Is it because the research isn't there? Or is it because these animals have already gone extinct? Like, how many cryptids or how many creatures have gone extinct without us even knowing about them? And maybe just one or two stories about them. And because the population was so low, we never see them again.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, it, you know, and then there are the ones like the Tasmanian tiger, stuff like that, that may well still be out there in very small population.
Yes. You know? I think it was a couple of years ago, they even did a calculation stating that, most likely, at least to them, the Thylacine most likely survived into the 1990s. I still think it's still sighted nowadays, so I think there's still a population of them. But, like, even calculations state, they survived way beyond their extinction date back in 1936, especially even mainland Australia, there's sightings of the Thylacine. And the Thylacine supposedly went extinct on mainland Australia literally thousands of years ago, but there's still sightings of them. Like, even there's a lot of sightings of these also cryptid felines that can be this prehistoric species that have survived into the modern day. Like, one that I've been doing a little bit more research because I only found out about recently is a Gao Shan Yang. These are supposed long famed tigers that live in the mountains of China. But long famed tigers, you're referencing something like a Smilodon. But a lot of these Chinese cryptids aren't really heard about a lot because the Chinese government and just the lack of information coming from parts of China. But there's a lot of cryptids out there, especially the felines, that don't really get the spotlight like they should. Like, a lot of people hear about them because they're just either the sightings aren't really concurrent into the modern day or just the lack of research into them.
Well, and the lack of research into them is where things get interesting, you know, because it's one of those I always quote Adam Davies from the time that we had him on from Texas Bigfoot Conference, which is rapidly approaching, folks. And he was like, it doesn't matter if I'm going out on my own or with National Geographic to search for the Yeti or the Mongolian death worm. Doesn't matter what I'm going out to search for. It begins with localized stories.
Yeah.
And if there aren't enough localized stories or if the stories are in full conflict with each other, things like that, then it's not really worth it to investigate further. And from there, once you have enough localized stories that are similar and have similar descriptions and things like that, now you start looking at the actual area. Would the area support it? Would the local wildlife support it? Would the grazing and mating habits be supported? Would it support a breeding population in that area? And if so, now you move further down the line of investigation, which is, let's mount some money and get out and put trail cameras out or, you know, start figuring out where the prime locations may be.
Yeah. And like with the whole localized stories, this is something that I've kind of have talked about for the past couple of years, especially when it comes to international cryptozoology. What if like there's not like especially you get the big names of cryptozoology, especially from the United States, parts of Britain, but there's a lot of other places with cryptid sightings that there might be local researchers, but just due to the lack of connection, we don't really hear about, or that's unconnected to the larger world of cryptozoology. And those stories get lost. That research gets lost. And if there's not a lot of local people talking about these creatures, but not really putting together the stories and really putting them into like almost like in a record, those stories get lost. Old traditions get lost. So that's why it's up to like a lot of researchers like me, myself. I try to look at like the local stories and try to not lose that information, because like, for instance, with a lot of like indigenous stories of these cryptids, once that indigenous population is gone, so the old information they had about these local creatures.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And my people are a great example of that. It's something that I bring up regularly on the show is the Cajun culture and the idea of exactly how fast the Cajun language has disappeared. It is, it's been all of a generation, maybe two, and it's gone. Yeah. Like there are active efforts to revive the Cajun language, to keep the Cajun culture going, things like that. But when you lose that, Now things like proper stories and histories of things like the Rougarou are told in different ways, you know, and that's something that you and I have talked about regularly on this show. When you start looking at traditional stories of the Wendigo, it's 100% different than, you know, a deer-headed creature coming out of the woods, Wendigo.
Yeah, so it's the almost bastardization of indigenous stories with European folklore. It's you see this around the world. You see indigenous stories originally, and then when Europeans or any type of colonization occurs, it gets bastardized and mixed in with their culture. So the original one kind of dies out after a while. Like, for instance, one thing with language you brought up, there's a lot of languages that around the world, especially indigenous language, that maybe one or only two people speak. And then once one person or two people die, that language is forever gone. And this has happened around the world several times. One I've heard about recently is the Sentinelese Islands. These islands off the coast of Africa, off the coast of India, there's literally 12 or 13 different language families that all exist there, but there's literally one or two that literally there's only one living person that speaks the language. But the language existed for thousands of years, but only one person now has it because of British colonization. They destroyed the indigenous culture.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. And with that language, go religious practices. With those religious practices come beliefs. And when those beliefs go, then beliefs in the stories, belief in the folklore, all that stuff gets swept away with it.
Yeah.
You know, because if you have no need of the old gods, then you have no need of the guardians of the old gods. You know, the critters that live in the woods that exude their spirit. And things like that, you have no need for those stories anymore. So they disappear. And all we end up with is a jaguar head on a piece of rock. And we have to figure out why. You know?
It's the ideas of like how culture is, how a lot of indigenous cultures will just die out. It's really quite sad, because it's like how many cultures have gone, like for instance, I bring up like when Columbus discovered America. Some of those populations of indigenous that he discovered, supposedly, no one talked about afterwards. They literally went extinct the next couple of years because of all diseases. So how many cultures and how many languages have we lost just due to us just not discovering them quick enough?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, of course, how many times kind of the whole reason for the first protocol of the Galactic Foundation is that you do not interfere. Feel free to observe the culture, write what it's about, anything else, but do not interfere. Because as soon as you interfere, like you are getting involved with something that may bring it into their society as you know it. And of course, make no mistake, we would have zero episodes of Star Trek without interference. Zero. None. Let's go down. That's kind of interfering, dude. just popping down to the surface in front of everybody is straight up interference.
Yeah.
So, oh, well, we did it anyway. And you know, that brings up something with science, and that's the idea of how do we get to that next level, Ryan? How do we impress upon researchers that are out there on the weekend, that are out there doing good work, no different than anybody trotting through the woods with a PhD. I don't think that the intent of any Bigfooter or crypto hunter out there is to do any kind of harm to the environment or anything like that. But how do we get them ready to give data to science? And how do we get science ready to accept that data from somebody out in the midst, out there literally hoofing it on the weekend, doing these things, like our friend Rod Nichols, who's out all the time with Bayer County Bigfoot, looking for Sasquatch holes and hides and structures, things like that.
Well, one thing I always tell them, and one thing I know you always bring up, is like the proper way to collect data. And like one thing I always tell people is, like Eddie Montrain said it himself, school never got in the way of my learning. Like, just because you might not be properly taught within biology or properly taught within zoology doesn't mean you can't collect data. That's and right. Knowing how to separate it from biases and stuff like that, like, people always have to realize, too, like, what you bring up a lot is when you do research, you also bring in yourself. You bring in your own mind. So you also bring up your own biases towards the research is – one thing I've always noticed, especially with a lot of, let's just be honest, Bigfoot researchers, they already go in with the answer already in mind. Mm. Don't go in with the answer. Go in with more questions than answers. Because if you have an answer already set, you're, of course, going to find the data that supports that and ignore anything that doesn't.
Yeah.
So always when you go into like any type of research or any type of problem solving, don't go in with any type of biases or any type of answers already set, because you might find data that totally goes against what you already have a hypothesis for, because you have to have a hypothesis first and then collect the data to prove it or not. And if it doesn't prove it, then you have to go back and rewrite it. And that's the biggest thing that a lot of people don't do, is because, let's be honest, we don't like to prove ourselves wrong. We don't like to think ourselves as wrong. But if the science doesn't have that, you have to go back and do it. Like, yeah, the scientific method, always start with observation and question. A lot of people always start with a conclusion in mind before they even observe or question. You have to start with a question first, because without questions, you never get to the answers. You can't have answers then questions.
Yeah. And I bring it up in just about every talk that I give. The idea of, if you look at those first two, observation and question, you know, then researching the topic area, like once you've had an experience, science began, whether you liked it or not, you are now a citizen scientist. Like, immediately, as soon as you've had any kind of paranormal experience, you are immediately a citizen scientist. Now, the only difference is whether or not you're collecting data, whether or not you are forming an educated opinion and researching that topic, you know, and in a proper research way, and willing to look at the data that you gather beyond the lens of your experience and beyond the lens of your own experience in that kind of way.
Yeah. No, and like one thing, especially in recent years, I've brought up a lot is, I've noticed within the fields of like paranormal research, things like that, you kind of get a bias almost away from science. People think, well, the scientists don't think we know what we're doing, so we're going to get away from it. And I'm like, we have to have the marriage of science and superstition.
That's right.
What's normal and what's paranormal, because I always like to tell people this. Old magic is science that we don't know about.
That's right.
Old normal is in cryptozoology, and old this is science that we haven't discovered yet. Like, gravity existed before Isaac Newton discovered it.
Well, and yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. It fully existed before then. And, yeah. And like Arthur C. Clarke says, any good technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Yeah.
Like if I took my phone right now back to 1950 and showed it to my dad.
Yeah. Like,
I mean, A, I guess he'd be like 8. But still, it would fascinate people, you know.
What type of futuristic device? What type of,
yeah.
Like, they would think you like space age stuff. Like,
yeah, yeah.
For instance, like, think about it. Like, we'll talk about Star Trek. Think tricorders. Yeah. Tricorders from the original Star Trek series are now just cell phones.
Yeah.
You see that technology. Like, what was thought of as fictional or thought of as magic is now what we think of as just modern day science.
Well, and, you know, that brings a perfect wrap to this because, in the same way, the cryptid becomes real, you know, becomes an actual species. Because as we've discussed before, if we weren't listening to locals, if we weren't listening to indigenous tribes, we wouldn't have things like the lowland gorilla.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have sought them and looked for them. But even that took years from the point of being interested and going, okay, let's make an expedition. Took years from the point of interest to the point of finding.
Yeah.
So many of these things, many of these topics, we are just burgeoning on that time. Even Sasquatch, and in the way that we have looked for Sasquatch beyond a story, like, hey, let's scientifically go out and look for another species. We are just coming to that gap now, so it's fascinating to see these things.
Yeah, but what I mean, you talk about the timeline of discovery.
Yeah.
Gorillas were referenced as wild men in the woods for hundreds of years before we ever discovered them.
Yeah.
The same idea as the modern day Sasquatch. Like,
yeah.
Stories almost never just stories. Like, people don't waste their breath on just making fiction like that. They do it so often, but where can we make the story into science?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And once again, where can we draw that line to and from? Because we've got to be able to take science and look at it from the other direction as well, you know, yeah. and be able to point it at a story from data that we've gathered. So, Ryan, I want to thank you as always for coming on, for banging these ideas out, for chatting about stuff. We actually have a symposium of the strange coming up. That'll be super fun. Aside from that, where can everybody find you? Where can they reach you with stories, accounts, things like that? Where can they go and find your books?
Well, of course, books on Amazon. If you look up my social medias, you can look up Ryan Edwards on Facebook, Instagram, things like that. I also have, of course, we also have the Symposium of the Strange, which you can always get contacted from there. My books are Crooks of the World, Sasquatch of Prehistory, and Beyond Bigfoot. Also, I will be at the Texas Bigfoot Conference later this year. I will be one of the speakers in Jefferson, which honestly, dream come true this year. Like,
it's gonna be great.
Speaking at a conference that when I first came to it, I was just a visitor, just an observer, you might say, looking at the research. And now I'm someone speaking at it. So that's something I'm really looking forward to later this October.
Well, it's going to be great. I can't wait to see your presentation there. Make sure you stop on by and check out all of Ryan's works. You can find all of them on Amazon. You can, of course, find all of them right on The Curious Realm, everybody. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. Ryan, thank you as always for hopping on the show and talking.
Welcome, brother. Always good to come on.
While you are online getting all of Ryan's books, everything else, make sure to stop on by also Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find our awesome events page. If you go to CuriousRealm.com/events, you can find all of our live coverage from amazing events like the recent Cygames that we just went to in Virginia. That was an amazing event. We will also be going to the 9/11 conference coming up. That will be awesome, and I cannot wait to get our coverage there. Thank you so much, as always, everybody, for your time tonight. Thank you for your open hearts, your open minds. That is what makes the conversation possible, and without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit GroundZeroPlus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious, and remember, the other side is always watching.